The All Souls Forum is a public forum from the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. It deals with significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values of the contemporary world and that promote critical thinking. While the All Souls Forum is on a summer hiatus, we will present programming of a similar nature. This week, Nellie Fagan of the Rio Grande Borderland Ministries, or RGBM, will give a short presentation describing the work and mission of RGBM, followed by a panel discussion on the ongoing crisis along our southern border. Members of the panel are from several organizations, principally RGBM, and the Lawrence Interfaith Refugee and Immigrant Ministries, or LIRIM, working with immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. They will discuss conditions and procedures that immigrants face and what programs are available to help them.
Hello. My name is Nellie Fagan, and I'm the project coordinator for Rio Grande Borderland Ministries. Rio Grande Borderland Ministries, or RGBM, began as a coalition of congregations, clergy, and volunteers of the Episcopal Diocese of the Rio Grande, responding to chronic poverty on both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border. Following the Episcopal Diocese of the Rio Grande's deep involvement in the colonial rights movement, congregations from the Big Bend of Texas to southwestern New Mexico took on the work of continuing to care for God's people in one of the poorest regions of the United States. From construction projects to facilitating cottage industries, congregations in the Episcopal Diocese of the Rio Grande were about the gospel work of making sure that everyone eats, everyone is clothed, everyone has a safe place to live and know they are loved, which is RGBM's mission statement. Changes in immigration policy and enforcement in early 2018 brought a change of culture to the region and an abundance of new challenges to the Episcopal Diocese of the Rio Grande. Existing systems for asylum were dismantled, border enforcement was increasingly aggressive, and entire families were detained for prolonged periods of time. Beginning in the summer of 2018, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, began releasing migrants into the streets of El Paso, Las Cruces, and Albuquerque without warning. The Episcopal Diocese of the Rio Grande and RGBM responded by sheltering these migrants in congregations and in the Diocesan Conference Center in Albuquerque, engaging more than 300 volunteers in the process of feeding, clothing, and caring for these asylum seekers. As quickly as the buses full of migrants arrived, they stopped with the implementation of the Migrant Protection Protocol, or the Remain in Mexico policy, and the networks that were built to care for migrants in the U.S. suddenly shifted to engaging needs on the south of the border and building relationships with those local, state, and federal agencies in both the U.S. and Mexico that would be our partners in the journey. Through existing relationships in Ojinaga and Ciudad Juarez, we partnered with the Anglican Diocese of Northern Mexico and civic leaders in the Big Bend to allow for on-the-ground engagement with the needs of those whose American dream was turning into a nightmare. This crisis has brought us to the river. It has brought us to the bridges. It has brought us to the barrios and into the offices of Border Patrol commanders. In every place, our call is becoming clearer. To be the presence that makes a difference, to build relationships that will outlast this crisis, to meet the moment we are in and build for the moments that are to come. Migration and poverty will be with us in the borderlands. The economic challenges of this region still persist, and among the ranks of the asylum seekers arriving in our partner shelters are the first wave of climate refugees whose lives and livelihoods have already been uprooted by climate change. RGBM has been engaging with long-term systemic needs on the border for decades by working collaboratively to provide humanitarian support to vulnerable people in our border communities. RGBM supports shelters on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, serving asylum seekers, unaccompanied minors, and indigenous persons in our border communities of Ojinaga and Juarez, Mexico. RGBM also partners with Boquillas and Beyond Mexico Mission to help bring solar to rural areas, as well as supports the Women's Co-op in Palomas, Mexico, through our partners in Columbus, New Mexico. Since the Remain in Mexico policy was lifted, RGBM has been helping asylum seekers who cross into El Paso get to their new homes and sponsors throughout the U.S. We help to ensure that our migrant neighbors are embraced in service of justice, in the interest of dignity, and in the spirit of love. The compassionate response of RGBM is simple: to feed, shelter, and care for our neighbors on both sides of the border. One thing that is unique about RGBM is our bridge chaplaincy. Our bridge chaplain, Anna Reza, works to connect volunteers with direct opportunities to be a pastoral presence in the lives of migrants and asylum seekers through volunteer training and coordination, engagement with our Anglican partners in northern Mexico, and building relationships with local partner organizations in New Mexico and far west Texas. Our bridge chaplain also offers pastoral care to all who seek it, connecting individuals to others who might best be able to help them and engaging church leaders in acts of solidarity and advocacy. This role has been unique over the last year, given the limited opportunities for in-person connection and travel restrictions, but Anna has still lived into her role of building relationships and fostering community. If you are interested in learning more about RGBM and making an impact, I invite you to visit riograndeborderland.org or email me, Nellie Fagan, the project coordinator, at admin@riograndeborderland.org. Thank you.
The recording of the panel discussion began after the discussion had begun. The speaker is describing the process of transporting immigrants and asylum seekers to sponsors or locations within the United States.
Then once the paperwork is done, and the sponsors we've verified that, yes, this is who they are and where they live and their ability to care for the for the unaccompanied minor. If they are 12 years of age or older, then they cross over and we put them on a bus to get to where they're going. If they're under 12, then the sponsor has to come down and pick them up because they're too young to navigate the bus system. So sometimes we send them to Hollywood, Florida, and Detroit, Michigan, and Las Vegas, and all over the place. And you can imagine trying to figure out how to transfer and things of that nature. So we do that. A lot of times people are picked up who have crossed the border, and they're picked up by United States citizens. And then we work with the Border Patrol. We have a great relationship with the Rio Grande, the Big Bend hospital here. It's a regional hospital. And so fortunately for everybody, the head of that hospital says he cares to treat people. He doesn't care about the insurance. He doesn't care where they come from. And so initially, when someone's picked up either by the Border Patrol or some civilian, they're brought to the hospital where they get a physical and then figure out where to go next. And then we've been working with the Border Patrol to take groups of people. We have a coalition of churches here. No one church or denomination can do this work. And so we all work together. And we have a coalition of churches where we can house families and individuals who come across. Most people only don't want to stay here because they do have family and friends, and they're trying to get to another part of the country. So when they are cleared and given to us to be responsible for, we make sure they have clothes they need, they have food, they have bus tickets, and then we make sure they understand what they have to do on the bus. So for example, this young couple we sent to Detroit, we make these index cards. They had to change buses 4 times. So we made these index cards, one side's in Spanish, the other side's in English. so that when they get, and they're numbered uno, dos, tres, cuatro. And so when they get to the next stop, they can pull out their card, show it to someone in case they're confused so they can get to the right bus. And then they call us when they're where they want to be. And yeah, I think that's enough. And then I can answer specific questions and everything.
Great. Well, I know that the main two kind of questions that y'all had sent us beforehand were regarding Title 42 and unaccompanied minors.
Nellie, can you do me a big favor, Nellie? Remember that map that we took out? Can you just put that up just so you can kind of see what Lee, Lee was talking about and Michael Wallens? I forgot to ask you earlier, and I just remember right now, so I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that is, thank you for that reminder. Yes, beforehand, we were talking about how we wanted to be able to give y'all a visual, and Chuck pointed this out to us bear with us because this isn't the most beautiful of maps, but it'll.
Well, while you're pulling that out, Nellie, I can just do a real quick rundown on some of the acronyms. Part of a risk you run living on the border is we have acronyms in English and in Spanish. And we use them freely and interchangeably. So if you hear us talking about MPP, that's the Remain in Mexico policy, which was instituted in the early summer of 2019.
The map referred to as a standard map of New Mexico and Western Texas.
CBP's Custom Border Patrol, ICE's Immigration and Customs Enforcement,
Juarez, Mexico, El Paso, Texas,
which you may hear
Oginaga, Mexico,
U.S. Customs and Immigration Service,
are highlighted.
A number. So if you're hearing things like that float around, please just put, hey, acronym in the chat, and we'll do our best to get to that.
And this map actually came from a newsletter, right, Nellie? And Nellie she's been such a big support, Blueprint, and we're blessed to have her. And that's the kind of stuff, you know, she puts out a newsletter. She has the website. Please go in there, check it out, subscribe to the newsletter. And you can look at past newsletters where we have like volunteers talk, right, Nellie?
Yeah, we have all sorts of, in our most recent newsletters are video updates, primarily from Ken and Lee, but then also there's a recent interview between Anna and Bishop Hun, as well as volunteer testimonies. And if you scroll back far enough, you see a podcast that Mike was on with Episcopal Migration Ministries that gives a really good kind of broad scope of the ministry. So we're hopeful that you'll continue to learn about the work that's happening. And of course, I'm hopeful that you'll sign up for the newsletter to stay. It's biweekly, so it's not anything too crazy and we won't inundate you with too much, but just to stay updated, we really appreciate that. So I will send the link, but yeah, so this map just gives you a sense of kind of where we're working. Of course, the Diocese of the Rio Grande is New Mexico and far west Texas. So you can kind of get a sense of it here. But again, it is not the most. there's just some blurbs here. But yeah, so I will pull that down just so we can see each other again. I wonder if it would be helpful to kind of open up more broadly to questions. Since kind of those main two pieces y'all covered, I know that Lee has been kind of tackling some of the questions within the chat, but if there are other questions that folks have, feel free to unmute yourself and ask. This can be kind of more conversational if you would like. And then we can also talk more in a bit about ways to get involved.
I know there's a couple of things that that we hear on the news, and then we hear people say, well, that's not quite the way it is. But some of the things are regarding the unaccompanied minors, and it seems as though maybe that, I don't know if it's slowed down or just the news on that has slowed down, but there were just these large numbers, unaccompanied minors coming across the border There were some question as to whether families were just sending their kids across because they knew they could get in, and they could, and the parents couldn't. But they were being sheltered in these large detention centers, really, that were used earlier. And some of them had been shut down earlier, but now they were being refilled. Are these kids getting placed? I know, Lee, you said, and I've heard that the large number of people coming across have some relatives. I know I heard that 40 to 50% of the unaccompanied minors coming across may have a parent actually in the U.S. Or some other relative that they can be sent to. So that's one question. The other is, are new asylees being allowed through? Or are they just backlogging those still in Mexico and only allowing those who are in the Remain in Mexico program through at 100 or so a day or whatever that number is now?
Mm-hmm. I'll go ahead and take the first question as to the unaccompanied minors and kind of what that was, what that is. It is still ongoing. The new Secretary of Homeland Security, Alexander Mayorkas, he was interviewed about 2 months back by now. And he said something that I think we can't understate enough. Our infrastructure for regular, you know, kind of what we think of as regular immigration, right? Of work visas, green cards, things like that. Our immigration infrastructure and our asylum infrastructure was systematically dismantled over the last 5 years. And we are and what we have not been able to do is rebuild that in 3 months. So again, like even just for our example, we took a shelter infrastructure operating here on the US, not just us, but nonprofits all across far west Texas and New Mexico, all across the US border, took our infrastructure that we had built up to respond to a crisis on the US side, pushed it across to the Mexican border, enabled our Mexican partners. And now we're not needing to just rebuild on the U.S. side. We're needing to rebuild on the U.S. side while still maintaining a Mexican infrastructure. And so what we're experiencing in a lot of ways is the unaccompanied minors arriving now are an expression of hope that the policies of this administration would be more humane. And at least for my part, one of the big things right now is this administration is working to clear out that backlog. Are they doing it as quickly as I would hope? And in the exact way that I would hope? No. But what we are seeing now is a reduction week over week in the number of unaccompanied minors in ICE custody, which is a good thing. The other thing too, which Anna mentioned a little bit, is wanting to, we're working really hard to make sure that this administration knows that Title 42 and the way it's been implemented currently is helping to exacerbate this crisis. Part of the issue is we will deport whole families under Title 42, but we will allow unaccompanied minors to remain. And so we have families all across the border who are making a horrendous calculus to say, if I send my kid alone, they will be safe. But if they stay here with me, I don't know. And the way that we disincentivize that is by allowing whole families across, even under Title 42. Mike, Anna, anything else on that piece?
No, it's just that it's heartbreaking. I can tell you that out here, and the other thing to keep in mind, right now there's no consistency along the border. So you've got different port of entries that handle families and children differently. There's no standard procedure. And so it's like out here, the Border Patrol has to do the best they can. Right now, though, it's heartbreaking when an unaccompanied minor comes across and you have their parents are not allowed in because they're adults. And so they, as Lee said, they have to make that choice. Do I keep them with us, or can I hope and pray that they will be taken care of in a better way than we can right now in Mexico, or even the scary part of going back home where they came from? So it's nothing that I think any parent would want to have to make that decision, and yet they do all the time, and it's really out of love for their children.
Yeah, and one of the things, like I mentioned before, we're still in the phase one of the MPP cases going through, and Title 42, as I said, these six NGOs and ACLU are fighting for people who, there's a loophole in Title 42, which includes very vulnerable people, and those, so they're not supposed to be deported, but it's happening, it's still happening. So case to case, people, you know, at least 24 a day come in. Today we had a family from the shelter. Yesterday we had another family from the shelter that came through in with that Title 42. So they're exemptions. It's not the full they're seeking asylum, it's still an exemption. There's still a whole legal process for that. I mean, the people who are seeking asylum is also a legal process, but now it's another added because they're just exemptions and they're trying to fight this. And there's around 26,000 people that would qualify for the phase two. And the phase two is they're fighting for people who on their way, they never made it to the interview, on their way to their interview, got kidnapped, something happened, they went back to their, you know, et cetera, out of fear. And so that still needs to work. But the biggest is to end Title 42 is what, you know, we can advocate to our elected officials. Right now, I think it just got renewed because it gets renewed every time the bridge is closed for non-essential products. So people, there's a mixture of right now that the MPP is the pendings. It's a mixed status, which means that somebody in their family is going through the MPP program. So, you know, trying to get the whole family to be included. But yeah, since right now during this time, it's only going Monday through Friday, and there's like 76 people, which include the MPPs plus those 24 from Title 42. And someone asked about testing. The ones that went through the whole, you know, they created this process, the NGOs in Juarez, the UN plus the US side, and they do get tested. So part of that, they get, it's a rapid test, and that happens right before they cross. And but the Title 42, that's a mixed bag. Some get tested, some don't. Anybody who comes from Border Patrol is not tested. So the shelters themselves are, through the help of the county, Annunciation House, are providing that test. There's other places in Arizona. I was at a meeting this week that are starting to give people the vaccine. You know, because now that we have a lot, you know, either the Johnson & Johnson or Moderna, most people are taking it. Some are deciding until I get to my destination. But that's something that, you know, we continue to work on, and that we in El Paso have, doctors have advocated, because at this time we have plenty in our city that we can, you know, do that and continue to protect the asylum seekers and the communities that they're going to.
Yeah, out here, what happens is that if a to the shelter Nohinaga, they're tested right away. The unaccompanied minors, if they test positive, then we have a relationship with several orphanages, and their orphanages are able to quarantine the children. We can't do that at the shelter. right now. So they are sent to the orphanages, and then they come when their 2 weeks are up or whatever, they come back. And if they cross, other people, when they cross by the Border Patrol, as I said before, they're taken immediately to the regional hospital here, and they're tested there. And then depending on what happens with this test, sometimes they'll be put in the hospital. Other times, the Border Patrol has no, their facilities here, they can't quarantine people. They, it's just a one size fits all holding place. And so in some cases, we do have some casitas and everything that we could put people with COVID in. And then we have some doctors and nurses that work out of the hospital who also will work with us. But we haven't had to do that yet.
I have a really I'm Catherine Robley, and I have a pretty basic thing. I'm sure there's a difference in definition between shelter and detention center. That's one question. And very similar to it then, if you're in a shelter, are you there for a long time? And how do you get out? And why do you get out? And all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great question. It looks a lot of different ways depending on where you are. So Mike, why don't you tell us when you talk shelter in the Big Bend, and then I'll tell you a little bit on our end.
For us, a shelter is a place of safety. There's social workers, there are people to look after them. They can, in Ojinaga, they can come and go out of the shelter. So some people have been there and they're able to find some jobs while they're waiting to come across. Detention, on the other hand, in Sierra Blanca is your basic prison. I mean, barbed wire all over the place, locked doors. You go in one door and it slams shut behind you. So it's a prison, basically. And that's the big difference here.
Mm-hmm. And it's an important distinction as well. The bulk of our shelter work right now is with our partners on the Mexican side. So they're awaiting a claim in northern Mexico, awaiting their chance to enter the U.S. and make their asylum claim. The shelters that that we largely operate on the U.S. side are really transient spaces, because by the time folks make it to us, they've been released from custody, they've had their credible fear interview, their first step on the asylum process, and they're looking to get with family as quickly as they can. And so in El Paso, the joke, I don't know that it's a funny one, but I make it anyway, is that we live up to our name of being the Northern Pass, right? Folks get here and they're gone. So the average shelter stay once they arrive here in the US is 2 to 3 days. And we do everything we can with the folks that we have relationships with to make sure that they're on their way to their new home in less than 48 hours if we can. Because the longer that they're staying in shelters, that's more chance for COVID exposure. And so we try to minimize that as best as they can. And so the numbers that we've seen here in the shelters on the US side are huge, but we've been working with our partners in Mexico. Have been hosting, some of these families have been living in these shelters for over 2 years at this point. And so these are really long-term kind of communities that build up with their own spirit and soul in really beautiful ways. But by the time they cross, we're helping them get to where they're going as quickly as we possibly can.
So the unaccompanied minors are being housed with immigration on the U.S. side. Those unaccompanied minors are being housed temporarily with contracted agencies, and then fairly quickly connected to their family members in other areas of the country.
Yeah, there's a process there. That's a little, and this is one of the places where you have a bunch of federal agencies that are overlapping, and it gets really confusing. So,
right, so we refugee have, services, right?
So unaccompanied minors are originally in ICE custody, not in Border Patrol custody. They're in Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody, and those places are detention centers. Those initial spots are detention centers. They are then placed with contracted service providers through the Office of Refugee Resettlement and the Department of Health and Human Services, where in those places they're working on getting them out. So what happened is, and is still happening to some degree, is when there's a backlog on filtering through the ORR end, the only option that was readily available was to inflate the detention side of it. And so what we're seeing now is more of a flow through in on the ORR side with their contractors. And so less need for detention space. Mike, is that what you're seeing out in Pecos in particular? Or?
Yeah. Pecos has right now, they have 900 unaccompanied minors there. They can house up to 2,000. And they're all boys, and their goal is to get those children out and where they need to go as soon as possible. Unfortunately, when you're in Ojinaga, what we do is it's expedited, and because we're smaller and everything. And we have a number of volunteers who can make those phone calls and really speed things up, and the Border Patrol can too. In Pecos, they are, I just saw advertisements in for social workers to come there to help make those phone calls to sponsors and everything and speed that up. But their goal is to get them out as soon as possible. They have no desire to keep them from who's ever sponsoring them.
So do we have any idea how many of these kids are going to make it through, you know, the immigration process and continue to be able to stay in the U.S.? Or, and how fast is that process going? And if they get deported, then what happens with that?
Yeah.
I know that's a lot of questions.
Yeah. I'll try and answer as quickly as I can. We don't know. We don't know. The immigration backlog prior to COVID, the asylum case backlog prior to COVID, asylum cases had to wait for an average of 18 months for an initial hearing, sometimes as long as 2 years if they had to be held by a judge. Asylum cases do not have to be adjudicated by a judge. They're initially adjudicated by a USCIS agent in a non-confrontational setting. And if that doesn't go well, they can be appealed to a federal judge. So the short answer, and it really depends on the federal district that you're in. In New Jersey, for example, 80% of asylum cases are accepted. In El Paso, it's less than 5%. And so the diversity on the federal bench, particularly as it pertains to immigration cases, is vast. And so it depends on the nature of their case. It depends on how long they have to wait. It depends on where their case is heard, whether it can be heard administratively or whether it needs to be heard by a judge. The biggest key to all of this succeeding is for these folks to have legal representation. The difference in successful asylum claims by somebody who is well represented versus somebody who is not is astonishing. And so those are places where, you know, within your local context, legal support is absolutely huge. And knowing a little bit about your federal immigration district also really helps. Before I came down to the Rio Grande, I was just outside of Chicago, but I was actually in Indianapolis, because nobody down here knows where Indianapolis is, and rightly so. But we got to know the courts in Chicago, and they got to know us a little bit, and so that was particularly helpful for our asylees.
Hi, my name's Katerina. I know Nelly was going to be talking about how we can become involved. Could you start on that?
Yeah. Nelly, I don't want to steal your thunder.
No, go for it.
Okay. So right now, what is the most helpful to us for as long as the U.S. border is closed to non-essential travel is your financial support. The only way we're able to get support to our Mexican partners right now is through a slow trickle of in-kind donations and through financial donations to support their work to build up their infrastructure on the Mexican side. The other thing is to get plugged in and stay informed about what's going on. As y'all have already seen, the borderland shows up in the news, and it shows up very intensely for about 2 weeks. And then you don't hear about it for another 3 months. And then it shows up very intensely for about 2 weeks. And, you're staying informed through networks like Lirum, but other good ones that I would commend to you are, Episcopal Migration Ministries, another one of our partners. Staying informed absolutely is crucial. So during under COVID, while the pandemic is still among us, while the border is still closed, those are the two things I would recommend. We really need your financial support, and we really need you to connect with good advocacy organizations who are doing the work where you are. Post-COVID, however, we've got some really exciting possibilities, and what we would love to do is to work out a way to build relationships with you over the long term, to get you down to see, to not just hear the stories, but to see what it means to be in this just really remarkable part of the country, and to know what it means for the river to not be, you know, the Rio Grande to not be a dividing line, but a gathering place, to be in a place like El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, where its heart beats as one city. But there's a giant wall in the middle of it. To know what it means to be in this place, and that way, y'all can tell the stories in a way that other folks can't. Right, and that's the biggest thing that we need right now is folks to see that that the border is not this big scary thing. I mean, we live in places where the border crossed us, you know, like the border crossed New Mexico and far west Texas. We didn't cross the border. And so those stories and those relationships are things that we're hoping to develop post-COVID with, particularly with hospitality opportunities here, pilgrimages, chances to see and really dive into what it means to be in this place, even more so than, you know, our shelters in Ciudad Juarez and in Ojinaga and constantly need, you know, improvements that volunteers could be doing. There are solar panels that need to go up. There are schools that need to get built, but more so than that, y'all getting the stories from this place is what we're really hoping to be able to offer post-COVID. But for now, your financial support and your involvement in advocacy is amazing. And it's really what we need.
And then just another exciting thing. So like, as Lee said, the primary thing we need from y'all right now is financial donations, but also there are a lot of exciting things ahead in terms of thinking about the world post-COVID. And so one thing we can do now is think together and plan. And so we can't necessarily make the most concrete of plans in terms of timing or things like that, because of course, as we know, that this last year and then some has taught us anything, things are unpredictable. but we can think together about what a partnership might look like. Right now we are in the process of working with congregations and organizations across the country who are wanting to build kind of a more formal partnership and working together with them to discern what that would look like. And really we want your help in thinking about that. And whether that includes some element of fundraising or pilgrimage at some point, youth groups involvement, kind of the world is our oyster a little bit in terms of what we decide we want to do with that. So I know we won't necessarily be able to leave today with that, but I want to plant that seed in terms of hopefully y'all can discern whether it's as Lyrum or within your specific faith communities, whatever you decide, how you want to be involved. We are so grateful for any kind of partnership. And then, like I said earlier, of course, please sign up for our newsletter. Also on our website, there's opportunities to stay connected with us through social media and other forms as well. So those are my main plugs at the moment. But Mike, I don't know, did you have something you wanted to add? Yes, I'm passing it to you.
I think the other thing is be creative. I think sometimes we don't think about what some needs might be. And someone has come to us and said, well, we have, so for example, there's a church in Leesburg, Virginia, St. Gabriel's, and they make these prayer squares and they send them down here and then we give them to the people in the shelters and everything when they cross. And I would have never thought of it, but, and they're prayed over in Virginia. And the impact that has, I mean, when I've given them, sometimes people say, well, someone cares about us, you know, that type of thing. But I would never have thought about the prayer squares. And just to give you a quick story about the impact of those, when I, you might know or not know that Texas went through a deep freeze and all the grid that we used didn't hold up. And right in the middle of that, I got a call from the Border Patrol asking me to, if I could come down to where they were, because they had 11 men. One of them had died because of the freezing cold. And so and they wanted me to do the last rites. So I went down there and did the last rites. And at one point they had come in through Ojinaga, but missed the port of entry. And so when this was, the last rites were given, one of them turned to the Border Patrol and said, is this Father Mike? And yeah, the Border Patrol said, yeah, it is. And at which point they all reached into their pockets and pulled out their prayer squares. And we all just started crying. So even some things that you think might be helpful, let us know, and then we can make sure that it will be used. So don't shortchange your creativity in outreach.
And we're happy to work with y'all if you want to have an event or any, I mean, in addition to this, has been an amazing conversation. And we're so grateful for your interest. But again, if you want to have future fundraising events or anything like that, we're so grateful for any kind of collaboration y'all want to have.
Yeah, just, I think Lyrum will continue certainly to have a direct communication with you. But for those, the others on the call here who are feeling like I need a place to connect, we will probably start some discussions on how we can be more involved. We will maybe have some more Zoom calls like this and draw people in. If you have ideas, I put the Lyrum email address early in the chat post there. if you have some ideas or want to engage us, please connect with us. Or if your congregation or faith community might be able to do something, please let us know. We'd be happy to be kind of a gathering place for those things that we can coordinate and send on to the Rio Grande region.
Nellie, I have a question for you. Yeah. So I'm also with Lyrum, but the church that I attend has a very active partnership with a Native American reservation. They take youth group there. There's an adult trip there once a year, youth group trip there once a year, among other things. But I'm just wondering, as a model, if that might be interesting for you. I could connect you with the minister who's in charge of that program at the church I attend.
Absolutely. I think any kind of model, we definitely don't want to be reinventing the wheel here. So if you have resources that you think would be helpful to us, we will never say no to them. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll be in touch with our assistant minister, who is also in charge of the youth program. And I think she'd be very happy to talk to you.
Great. Thank you.
So I'm going to swing back to kind of the beginning. I think it was Julie that was talking about the reasons that Latin Americans are coming. You said it was no longer primarily economic, but environmental, like in Honduras. And you mentioned violence against indigenous groups. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me just a little bit more about that?
There are a number of indigenous kind of the majority of people that speak Azteco Mayan descendant dialects in Central Mexico and Southern Mexico in Central America and Southern Mexico. Mm-hmm. And these folks, more than most, are subject to violence based on their indigenous identity. Their land, being displaced off land, being threatened by cartels, particularly because they're, because of their status as indigenous and the economic marginalization that tends to come with that. And it's to the point where I've been playing phone tag with a professor here at the University of New Mexico who speaks some of these Azteco Mayan dialects, because we're starting to receive folks for whom that's their primary language. And that has been happening. That's a recent example, but that's something that has been happening more and more since 2018.
Are Southeast Asians who are coming for, primarily more economic reasons, are they coming by boat and airplane, or are they coming through the southern border too?
No, they're coming by and large on H-1 visas, at least prior to like two or 3 years ago. They're coming primarily on H-1 visas, mostly to work in tech and some other sectors. Now, there are folks who do claim asylum, I think from, we've had all nationalities represented in our shelters in Ciudad Juarez. And so there are folks from all over who do try to come through the southern border. But by and large, asylum is really, really, like the process of seeking asylum is really, really hard. And the journeys that these folks have been on are many times nothing short of devastating. And so in terms of it being kind of an operative form of migration, we're not going to see that in the same way that we would see economic migration, right? Particularly an incentivized economic migration, which is what we've had what we've effectively said to workers from Latin America is, oh no, don't come in. Please don't come in. So the scale of immigration that we'll see from asylum will never match
what we've seen in the last 40 years out of Latin America, because it is by its very nature difficult. It's heartbreaking to have to leave your place of origin, and these folks would rather be at home by and large. And so, the most economic forms of migration are always going to be the dominant forms of migration. But we can't let that we don't tell that story.
Well, thank y'all so much. And Anna just sent her contact info in the chat. And I just want to echo what she said in terms of sending your energy and your prayers to the borderland, and particularly the diocese as they are navigating this journey, and just to our country as a whole, and pray that we are continuing to welcome with dignity. So we're striving to do so. I don't know that everyone always is, but we will continue to. So are there any remaining questions?
This is kind of a follow-up to Cindy's question. I'm just curious, the targeting of indigenous communities, is that because they're just easy targets because of poverty primarily?
By and
large,
or is there
some philosophical thing behind it? It's mostly just because they're easy targets?
At least in my experience, and Anna, I don't know if you've got any kind of, if you had heard any stories recently that might contradict this, but what I've, the indigenous regions of Central America and Southern Mexico are the most underdeveloped, and they're also some of the most rural. And so they're some of the easiest places for cartels to kind of develop. They also tend to be more progressive in places where kind of repressive regimes are the rule. And so we do get a mix of kind of political and criminal pressures driving folks out. And that's the same up in the Tarahumara, which Mike mentioned out in Ojinaga, they're the indigenous people who are native to what is now the state of Chihuahua, and they've experienced that same kind of dynamic in many places. They're easy targets, and again, they have a history of being progressive in a place where many of the regimes are not.
Thank you.
Sorry, I have another quick question. So for people who don't have a family sponsor, you said that there are some churches that are sponsoring those folks. And is that a formal process through Episcopal Migration Ministries, or is that, what's that process?
Anna's working with that right now. Anna, can you tell us what you know?
And that's the our partner with Episcopal Migration Ministry is the biggest important, because they do all of the formation. It does take a lot. I mean, there's a lot to it, but it's so needed. One of our volunteers, actually one of our shelter members, at the last moment, it was time for MPP to go over. His sponsor couldn't do it, especially after COVID. He lost his job. He didn't have the apartment he thought he had when he was going to welcome him 2 years ago, right? The space that he had. And so we're actually going through that process and watching how it takes a whole community in Silver City. The church there, Grace Episcopal Church, is partnering with him and helping him, teaching English to the family. But EMM, through that neighbor to neighbor program, is also doing the sponsor program. And there's a lot to it, the classes, sign the reality, but they walk you right through it. There's a webinar, there's a teaching, and there's information, and there's always support, because it's very needed. And like I said, it's just the process of that's created and all that it takes, and then the reality of of that relationship and what that means. But yeah, the Episcopal migration is a great resource. And it does take a process because it is such an important role that you will be playing in someone's life as they navigate the system.
I have another question too. So the church I attend has a free ESL, English as a Second Language program that before was on site, but now it's been taken online. And it's open to anybody, anywhere. And so I'm wondering if that's something that anybody that you serve might benefit from?
It's difficult for us, as I said, there may be a potential there. I'd love to have, if you want to reach out to Nelly or to Anna to see, with Zoom, we can connect people in from anywhere. What I will say in terms of people in the U.S., with some exceptions, by and large, once they arrive at their sponsoring friends or family, we don't really hear from them. Mm-hmm.
It can also be people outside the U.S. The only thing is they have to have, they have to have online capacity because the classes are being taught online right now. But we are actually currently, it's expanded a lot in this last year just because COVID forced us to go online. But I think we have some students in Colombia, for example. And there's a Spanish language component as well. It's not free, but it's cheap. So it could be also, I don't know, volunteers or even staff or somebody who needs to learn Spanish. So I'll send that info too.
Well, again, I'd like to thank our guests for coming on with us tonight. This has been a great, very informative discussion. And I can just tell from the chat here that there's a lot of interest in how we might continue this relationship. So, again, I want to encourage everyone online to write to us at the Lyrum Gmail address and let us know your thoughts and your ideas. And maybe we'll have you all back someday for another little chat as we follow up on this. As certainly as COVID moves its way toward nothingness, hopefully, there may be some other opportunities for us to engage with that. So thank you all.
Thank you for tuning in to the All Souls Forum. Keep your radio dialed to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, for your Jazz Afternoon with KC, coming up immediately, followed by The Boogie Bridge with Jason Vivoni, and then the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 p.m. In the meantime, have a great day.